Committee on the 1st of February. We have several matters before the committee this afternoon. Some cleanup ones that we'll take up first. Let's recognize committee members present, Representative Crawford, Representative Hayes, Representative Rookberg, and myself, Chair Murkowski. What I'd like to first do, we had taken up House Bill 343, Extend the Board of Professional Counselors, several meetings ago, and had discussed at that time the adoption of a letter of intent, or having the committee prepare up a letter of intent to urge a merger of that board with the marital therapists, as well as the other behavioral sciences members. That would be the psychologists as well as the social workers. And you should have in your packet a letter of intent. This was drafted not only by my staff, but in conjunction with Pat Davidson from the Legislative Auditor's Department. And you'll note at the bottom paragraph what we have worked into this letter of intent. We're not only suggesting that they combine the boards, but then in the interim before the next sunset, all of these four boards will sunset at the same time in 2005, but that as the boards are being reviewed by legislative audit, that there be a report on their progress towards this merger. So it's not when the audit report comes up in 2004, everybody wakes up and says, oh my gosh, I guess we need to start working on the merger of this. So it is urging their cooperation in the direction of a consolidated merger. I'm certain that this will evoke some discussion, perhaps heated discussion, by some of those in the profession that would rather retain their autonomy on their board. But I think the recommendation from the auditors is a good one. I think it's well taken. And the suggestion that all four boards be merged rather than just the two is one that is worthy of consideration. So I would encourage the committee members to take a close look at that. And if you have problems with it, certainly let me know what those are. And I'd like to be able to move this bill out today. I'd like your comments on that. Also need to point out in your packets you have an amendment, and this amendment relates to the number of hours that is required in the accreditation process for the professional counselors. And when we had taken up this bill, the Board of Professional Counselors had not yet met. They were going to be meeting 2 days after our meeting, and this particular issue was one that they were going to be taking up. And I would like Ann Henry to join us at the table and just update us as to the discussion at the board meeting last Wednesday and speak directly to this amendment, if you would.
For the board, my name is Ann, or for the record, my name is Ann Henry, and the board did meet telephonically on Wednesday afternoon, and we actually came up with an amendment, very similar, a little bit different in the wording, but everyone would be quite content with this language that you've proposed here in this amendment. It takes out the 48-hour requirement for the graduate program itself, which was limiting some folks' ability to get licensure in the state of Alaska, yet it maintains the 60-hour requirement overall, which keeps up the standard that we would like to see.
And can you just explain for the board members' edification what the specific problem was? There were certain instances where individuals had gone to accredited universities, if you could address that.
Yes, we recognize graduate programs from regionally and nationally accredited universities across the country, and some of those accrediting bodies allow various numbers of hours for semester hours for graduate programs, and because there were some folks that had graduated with as low as 35 hours of graduate work in their program that was indeed regionally or nationally accredited, they were not allowed to get licensed in the state of Alaska. And so we're basically removing that requirement that the graduate program be 48 hours minimum, which will allow those folks to come in and apply, but they will still have to have 60 hours total graduate hours, which was our high-end standard.
Okay. Are there questions of Ms. Henry or what the amendment is attempting to accomplish here? Representative Crawford? I could see that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not exactly sure what it's called, but when you go out and get a graduate degree, sometimes you get something called advanced standing, something, and you can do it in 1 year rather than two. Are you going to rule out those people that get the advanced standing because they did their graduate work in 1 year?
Basically, they will be allowed to apply if they have the total 60 hours of 60 semester hours of graduate work before, during, after, whatever, or not before, but during and after the graduate program. So there's a standard of 60 hours that some of the national accrediting agencies are recommending that people adhere to. They haven't all achieved that at this point, but so I'm not sure if those people would be. I don't think those people would be ruled out. They would have to take additional coursework.
So those people that got advanced standing, did their graduate work in 1 year's time, would have to go and get another year, even though they've already got their master's. And
yes. I'm not sure. I'm sorry, to the chair. I don't know exactly what advanced standing means. I'm not an academician.
Best of my knowledge, it's like people that were summa cum laude and magna cum laude got to skip some courses and got through with their master's work with less hours.
Mm-hmm. This statute definitely would not recognize that. What is happening in the state of Alaska right now is that Alaska Pacific University requires 60 semester hours for a graduate degree in counseling, psychology. University of Alaska, for a master's in science and clinical psychology or MED counseling guidance, is 48 or 45. University of Fairbanks is 48 for their programs. And the Council for Accreditation and Counseling and Related Educational Programs, which is the national organization, is really recommending that everyone go to 60. So. We have a high standard, and we recognize that, and we think it's pretty important to maintain that.
Yeah, so those people that are already practicing in Alaska, they'd have to go back and get 30 more hours to continue their license?
No. If they've been grandparented in, they have licenses. If someone has graduated from one of these programs and has 48 or fewer hours, they would have to take an additional 12 or whatever to come up to the 60 hours.
Ms. Henry, can I just clarify, as the statutes currently provide, they had to still have a total of at least 60 hours. So we're still requiring the 60 hours. It's just where before you could get is only required 48 in the, in the counseling area, and you could get 12 others elsewhere, but you still had to get a total of 60.
Madam Chair, the requirement was 48 hours within your graduate program, so you had to go to a program, a two-year program or whatever, and achieve 48 semester hours there, and then graduate, and then you'd have to pick up another 12 hours after that. And what we are finding in the last several months as we've been attempting to deal with people's applications is that a lot of people have gone to programs that aren't 48 semester hours within the graduate program itself. And because of the rigid way that the statute was written before, if they didn't have the 48 hours, we couldn't license them. So this opens it up so that if someone has 45, 39 hours, and then picks up the additional six, you know, whatever, to make 60 hours, they can be licensed.
Got it. Representative Hayes, did you have a question, or is that it?
Kevin, you asked my question. Thank you.
Are there further questions with regards to the amendment? Okay, well, since it's my amendment, I'll go ahead and move the amendment. Can I do that?
No, I'll amend it. Chair, I'd move.
Appreciate that.
Is it believed it would be amendment number one?
Amendment number one.
Marked as amendment number one, I'd move amendment number 122-LS1275/C.1, letter back 2102.
Thank you. Is there objection? Seeing none, we have adopted amendment number one. I made kind of the introductory comments on the letter of intent. Is there any discussion about the letter of intent? Any comments anyone would like to make in that regard?
Thank you.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you. I just appreciate you doing this. I think that was my interest that we have a letter of intent in charge attached. And
well, you had indicated that you wanted it to be strong, and I hope that it's strong enough. I think it sends a very direct message as to what it is that this committee is looking for out of it. So, good. Glad it meets your approval. With that, then, is there further discussion regarding House Bill 343? Seeing none, what's the will of the committee?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 343 as amended with individual recommendations in the attached fiscal note.
As well as the letter of intent?
As well as the letter of intent.
Okay. Is there objection? Seeing none, we will move from Committee House Bill number 343 as amended with the attached fiscal note and the letter of intent. And thank you, committee members, for your input on that. Next, we will move to House Bill 318. This is the Uniform Prescription Drug Card. And just for those that are in the audience, either here in Juneau or off-site somewhere else, we will be taking up the comprehensive health insurance as soon as we're finished with 318. I would like to get the rest of the testimony that we had kind of run out of time with on Friday, or I guess it was Wednesday. So, with that, I would ask Ms. Erickson to present the sponsor statement for House Bill 318.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Amy Erickson, staff to Representative Murkowski. House Bill 318, the Uniform Prescription Drug Card, was introduced at the request of the Alaska Pharmaceutical Association. Similar legislation has been enacted in 19 other states and is in the works in several others. The bill is intended to provide practical guidelines for organizations producing member ID cards and to provide consistent standards for those using the IDs so that waiting times for consumers and pharmacies are reduced and pharmacists have the information they need at their fingertips. The card contains basic but essential information like the name or logo of the card issuer, and you'll see in your packet there's a little sample here for you. Implementation of the uniform card will greatly aid pharmacists improve patient care by minimizing confusion. They'll be able to easily locate the necessary claims information. It will also eliminate unnecessary paperwork and decrease administrative burdens in processing claims. The card will streamline dispensing of prescription products, and patients will spend less time at the pharmacy waiting for prescriptions. It's a win-win situation.
How could you lose with that? I think it's only right and fitting that, as a committee, we acknowledge Ms. Erickson's contribution to the waistline of us all with the everyday cookies that we have in committee. I appreciate them, and I know that Representative Meyer does. And I get to eat Representative Rootberg's because he lets me, so thank you. Thank you. Representative Meyer.
Madam Chair, though, I don't think it's fair that our waistlines are growing and hers isn't.
Again, help you with that one, sir.
That's a great example of the power of giving.
I see. Yes, they are very good. Thank you.
Thank you. So, are there questions with regards to House Bill 318?
Madam Chair, I will note there are several people online that are from the Pharmaceutical Association to answer questions about the bill.
Well, then why don't we turn to, I can't tell where anyone is anymore.
Also, Madam Chair, we do have a CS.
I'm sorry, you're right.
Version J, I believe.
Thanks for bringing that to my attention. You do have the original House Bill 318 as well as CS for House Bill number 318, Labor and Commerce Version J. I would...
I'm trying to move Version J, CS for House Bill 318, Labor and Commerce Version J, 221LS1061/J4122.
Okay, we do have the Version J in front of us as a working document.
Madam Chair.
Representative Roper.
We have staff explain the differences there.
In
the CS, right?
Through the chair, Representative Roper. It's fine-tuned a little bit so that it looks more like the National Council for Prescription Drug Programs pharmacy card, their model language. That's how it's different. And actually, Erin Carrie Byrne is online, and she suggested those changes in particular.
Okay. Maybe we will go to Ms. Byrne, and she can first address the changes in Version J. Ms. Byrne, are you with us? Present the whole bill.
Oh, Barry. Barry Christensen and Roger Penrod are also there too.
Okay. Well, while we're waiting, is there anybody here in Juneau that intends to testify on House Bill 318?
Just for a brief one.
Go ahead, Mr. Bell.
I'm Guy Bell. I'm the director of the Division of Retirement Benefits, and we administer the health insurance for select benefits, approximately 5,000 state employees, and for retirees, approximately 23,000 retirees from public employees and teachers' retirement systems. We do use a prescription drug card, and based on conversations we've had with the staff, we believe our prescription drug card complies with the standards, and we have submitted a zero fiscal note associated with the legislation.
Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bell, do you see any downside to this bill at all? I mean, it seems like it's a win-win situation, but just looking at this bill, do you see any downside at all for the state or for any private sector employers?
From my perspective, no.
Representative Roper.
Mr. Bell, I'm kind of surprised to hear that. Is the card we have that we carry around with us, is that what you're referring to? Is this the qualification card? You think so that card, although it looks different and isn't set up as a pharmaceutical ID card, meets the requirements then? Is that what your testimony is?
That's correct.
So what if there was a change in formulary that the select group or the state decided to change and our third party administrator changes the formulary, then what happens?
I'm sorry, I need to ask my staff that question. That's more technical than I could answer.
If you'd like to come forward to the table, please.
My name is Janet Parker. I'm Deputy Director for Division of Retirement and Benefits. And the question was if we change the formulary.
Right. What if the third-party administrator on the direction of the state changed the formulary or made it an annualized adjustment or changes to it, which is very common?
But
the card still, how would that work?
Well, actually, the state doesn't use a formulary. So you're allowed to use any drugs you want, and maybe that's the issue that...
Maybe that is, right, okay.
With this bill, if that's the question. I would say over 90% of the pharmacies participate in the state's card program, and when you give them your card and they put your identifier in there, they know what is and isn't covered.
Well, we don't have a formulary then, so the question's moving.
Oh.
We don't have a formulary then, the question...
Oh, was this designed to address formularies?
Well, that's what I want to get to, but it doesn't. We don't have a formulary, so then it's moot.
Okay.
Sorry. That answers the question. I'll have to ask that of other witnesses.
Thank you. Appreciate the testimony. Do we have the online people online?
This is Roger Penrod. I'm online.
Okay.
Erin Carey Byrne is also online.
Ms. Byrne, there was a question that was asked just a little bit ago. This was... with regards to the changes in version J that the committee has before them as the work draft. Can you just briefly address the changes from the original bill?
Yes, I can. First, I'd like to apologize. Just as I was beginning testimony, I was cut off. We actually looked at the language and realized that we wanted to indeed be uniform throughout the Lower 48. This bill has been enacted in 19 states, and the reason that it's been so quickly adopted in so many states is in order to achieve that uniformity, not just in Alaska, but throughout. And so we are just simply complying with language, uniform language that's already been drafted in other states as well, to keep the model and the template uniform.
Okay, thank you. Did you have a specific testimony that you would care to give at this point?
Well, I think Amy did a wonderful job of summarizing the intent of the bill. From the Alaska Pharmaceutical Association perspective, Roger Penrod will be testifying. I am the executive director and as administrator for a membership organization. I'm not a pharmacist. However, I am a consumer, and I think we can all appreciate that time we spent waiting behind the counter. And it's not necessarily in the product or the prescription being prepared. It's in actually waiting to get simple information that should be on the front of these cards. And it will save a lot of time. I know that they have been quoting statistics like 70% of a pharmacist's time some days is spent just trying to chase down information. So this is simply trying to avoid those pitfalls that happen that we can easily work around.
Great. Well, thank you. Appreciate you being here this afternoon. Do people have questions of Ms. Byrne? Representative Roper?
Could she verify that the state's card is consistent with the ID card that would be required for the bill?
Ms. Byrne?
You mean the bill as it is would be consistent with...
The current card that's issued by Aetna as a third-party administrator to the select benefit group of Alaskan employees as well as retirees?
I'd have to look at the Aetna card in particular. I know that most of the major carriers, the information is already there. I think Roger Penrod, who deals, and Barry Christensen is also online, I believe, can talk to you specifically about cards that they've seen if you have specific questions about those cards.
Thank you. Well, then let's go to Mr. Penrod.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you for having me. To answer Mr. Rookberg's question, the Aetna card does contain all of the information that is necessary as required by this proposed legislation, as do most of the Blue Cross Washington Alaska cards. It's when we run into cards from people from outside that have a Blue Cross of Michigan or Oklahoma or Texas, that's where we sometimes have difficulties. And with some of the other various third-party players, and the one that I've seen most recently is one called SaveRx, and without a doubt, it requires a phone call and at least 20 to 30 minutes of my time each and every time we encounter these.
Thank you, Mr. Penrod. Do you have anything additional that you would care to add at this time?
Well, I would like to say that this type of legislation, as you can see, there's a trend in it nationwide. In the last several years, a number of states have passed that, two of them in 1999.
Great. Well, thank you. I appreciate your comments, and hopefully this will make your job easier, and as has been mentioned a couple times, everybody wins.
Well, may I go on to say that, you know, historically pharmacy, over the years that I've practiced, has been primarily a cash and carry thing, and in the last probably 15 years is where insurance has become a big player. Some 10 or 12 years ago, it might have made up 10% of our business, whereas today it makes up in excess of 80%. Because of that, we do, from time to time, run into those difficulties and billing problems, and that's what we really want to try to alleviate and just help the consumer out.
Great, thank you. Other questions of Mr. Penrod? Representative Roper.
Mr. Penrod, going back to my formulary question, what if there's a change in the formulary on an annualized basis? How would that be impacted by the card?
Well, Representative Roberg, it would not affect the card. The formulary is an agreement between your insurer, which is the state, and the third-party carrier. If they want to try to minimize dollar amounts by reducing the choices of, for example, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, of which there's been a couple of very expensive ones come on the market in the last couple of years, they may want to, say, phase those out and say, let's use these other drugs. But it doesn't affect the card at all. That's just a matter of business as to what your insurance will or will not pay for. As some pay for oral contraceptives, some do not.
Well, I guess my point is, would the numbers on the card indicate what type of formulary existed, or is that the formulary germane to the information contained in the card at all?
Not whatsoever.
So how do you know whether an insurance company is covering, insurance company's formulary would cover, however you were, the prescription you were writing?
Well, your physician likely would have received a booklet because the state, being such a large insurer, I'm sure would put this information out.
The state doesn't have a formulary, so they're not even an issue.
Right, this is not an issue.
I'm talking about Blue Cross or one of the other 150 insurers that are licensed to do health insurance in Alaska.
Well, that's when they begin to what I term practice medicine, which is just a little bit beyond their scope. We get through our computer, when we submit the claim, we get a rejection back saying that this drug is not, it says NDC, meaning National Drug Code, which is an identifier for that drug, is not covered, and they don't give any explanation. Or in some cases, are those drugs that have limits as to the amount that they will cover.
That's correct. I mean, isn't it your experience? You're a pharmacist, is that correct?
I am.
And you're aware that almost every company has a different formulary?
Fortunately, in Alaska, we haven't been affected by that too much.
That's because we have so few people writing insurance up here, probably.
Perhaps,
right. And what happens if you have... I don't understand then why this particular card is going to make that kind of difference.
Well, when I get a card such as I mentioned, the SaveRx card, that doesn't even have the individual's identification number on it, it doesn't even have a group plan, it's just got a, for pharmacy claims, call this 800 number.
Okay.
That's what I run up against.
So if it has the other information, are you able to use like the internet or other forms of communications or some type of circuitry, electronic aids or to communicate or what?
I don't think I'm understanding your question entirely.
Well, how is your communications cut down from 20 minutes if it's you have those other numbers?
We don't have to make any phone calls to find out what we need to use. That information is there on the cards. As I said, Aetna has it, Blue Cross Blue Shield Washington Alaska has it. There are some that don't, and it's those that don't that really create the headache and the problem. And when they don't have group numbers, they don't have patient names, this sort of thing, it's extremely difficult for us to process, It requires my time or that of one of my technicians to be tied up on the telephone with an insurance company, in which you get a maze of a telephone answering thing where you have to navigate through that before you can talk with a real person to find out how to fix it.
But you haven't run into difficulties then, as a matter of practice, as far as the different formularies from different drug underwriters, or health insurance underwriters?
Well, Representative Broberg, not so much with formularies. We haven't had problems with formularies per se.
Well, some companies cover some drugs and some don't. I mean, how do you know the distinction? Is that when you make that contact with them, or you know because of prior experience, perhaps?
Well, some of it's from prior experience, and again, it's an electronically submitted claim. When it comes back and says it's rejected and says the MDC or that, you know, this drug is not covered, we will show that to the patient and say, you know, this particular drug is not covered on your program. How would you like us to proceed?
Okay, well, that was what I was going to get. The electronically submitted, how is that done? Over the internet or what?
It's just through the telephone lines.
Oh, do you
Representative Murkowski, may I cut in? This is Erin Carey Burns.
Go ahead, Ms. Burns.
Well, I just want to make it clear, this card is an identification card for insurance carriers. The transmittal, the electronic transmittal that takes place closed circuit, it really has nothing to do with what we're seeking in terms of this bill. This is just simply a uniform-looking card. So in other words, when you go outside of the state of Alaska and you present your Alaska driver's license, we know that the information they're looking for, perhaps the ADL number, is going to be in a certain place in the license. In other words, there's some uniformity. They also know that that number is going to be on the front of the license. And that's all we're looking for, is uniformity. The formulary is completely specific to the carrier themselves, and that's all handled electronically. Pharmacists who have been around for a while certainly know some of these major carriers and what they will cover and what they will not cover. Really, the smaller carriers that we don't see often up here that present the problem.
And that's my next question.
Thank you. Go ahead, Representative Roper.
What happens if you have like a tourist or visitor from outside and they don't have something like that? That's Mr. Penrod, you go back to this problem where you the one card where you end up on the phone for 20 minutes. Is that right?
Well, Representative Roper, this is Roger Penrod again. If they don't have their insurance card, it's pretty cut and dry. They get to pay cash. If they have an insurance card that has inadequate information, we're back on the telephone again.
Well, what? Guess you take credit cards, though. Huh?
Absolutely.
Okay.
But do I understand correctly, though, that if right now you've got 19 states that have signed on to some kind of a uniform template here, that ultimately the goal would be that you could go from Wisconsin to Alaska and you would pretty much have the same type of stuff on the front of the card?
That is correct.
I understand that Liz Merton is also on the line and may have some information to help clear up some of the questions that perhaps Representative Roper has presented.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Lise Merton, and I work with the National Association of Chain Drug Stores. I'm the regional director in the Northwest, and thank you for letting me participate by phone this afternoon. I wanted to thank Amy for her overview. I thought she did an excellent job, and I would be more than happy to try and address Representative Roper's questions. As far as the formula, we kind of have that situation resolved, and as far as people coming in from out of state, really what, by having the card in Alaska and having it standardized, what you're going to do is cut down on the amount of time that the pharmacists in Alaska are going to have to spend with, say, well, I'm not a good example because I'm in Washington and we've passed the law as well, but say someone, for sake of argument, from Idaho, they haven't passed the law, they don't have a standardized card, that's one individual that perhaps Roger would have to deal with, as opposed to what he deals with now, and that's multiple people coming in during the day where he has to stop and make a phone call. Does that answer your question about kind of the standardized and how it works from out of state?
Yes.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Would you care to add anything further, Ms. Mertens?
If I could, just
go ahead.
I have some prepared comments for you. I just wanted to thank you for entertaining a piece of legislation and there are, our members, of course, is still with some minor changes. We don't necessarily need to talk about those right now, but we do have do some work on the bill before its final passage. I just want to let you know, in today's environment in Alaska, over 3% of all prescriptions are from third-party payers. So 3% of all the prescriptions, for example, Roger deals with, are coming insurance and companies where at the time he may have to deal with the issue of making a phone call and taking 20 minutes to deal with it. Pharmacists currently spend 20% of every working day dealing with problems just related to processing prescription drug claims. Despite the pharmacist shortage across the country, which includes the state of Alaska, and taking into consideration the focus on patient safety, our pharmacists would much prefer to be spending their time working direct patients, doing counseling, and helping them comply with their drug regimen. The bill before your committee asks very simply that if information is required to process a claim, it be included on the card. And I mean, that's really the essence of the piece of legislation, and that's really all we're asking for. I'd like to compliment the committee and the drafters of the language for being sure that the Director of Insurance is a big part of the implementation of this piece of legislation. I think that's the couple changes that I think we would like to see if we can work this as we work the bill through the process. We'd like to see the bill clarify who has to comply with this law, and we'd also like to clarify some language for the insurance, and that we don't anticipate or expect that they would have to issue new cards every time there's like a little change. I understand in Alaska on your driver's license you use a sticker, and that certainly would be an acceptable format that the pharmacist would be very comfortable with if the information were to change. So we're trying to make this as easy on the insurance as possible and not make this overburdened and tough for them to comply.
Well, thank you, Ms. Mertens. I appreciate your comments. You need to know that it's the policy of this committee that we like to have things practically perfect before it leaves. So I appreciate you bringing these two issues up that you think need to be fine-tuned. Who has to comply, as well as the reissuance of a card? And I don't know that I have had any conversations with anybody about how, whether you could just put a sticker on the card and have it be reissued, or whether that is going to be problematic. In terms of who has to comply, I thought it was any health benefit plan that provides for prescription drugs or devices that issues or uses cards. So I thought that was relatively clear. How would you make that more specific?
The only clarification, and I deeply apologize for not knowing the insurance laws in Alaska, so for that I am extremely sorry. The only, if these are included, then fine the way it is. Want to make sure that health benefit plans are included, insurers are included, health care insurance plans are included, managed care entities, and third-party administrators. If they're covered by that broad language, then there's not really a problem.
And I don't have the answer for you in terms of whether or not a health benefit plan in fact includes all those that you've just mentioned. I suppose we should ask one of our relative experts here if that is the case. Are you?
I had hoped when we added that language in that it was broad enough to incorporate all of those entities, and I'm not sure that it is.
Okay.
I wanted to be sure that it was.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. We also have online Barry Christensen down in, looks like, Ketchikan. Mr. Christensen.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. You, in your packet, you have a letter that I drafted on behalf of the association, and I won't say a whole lot more besides that this is an important bill. I will tell you that I am a practicing pharmacist. I'm fortunate enough to work with my dad, who is also a practicing pharmacist of about 40 years in Alaska. And almost single-handedly, I can say that's one of the most frustrating things he deals with in our day-to-day community pharmacy practice, is someone handing him a card that has some of the information on some place and some of it on the other, and ultimately ends up coming to me or one of our technicians and says, do we take this card? So this is just a standardization that that I think is going to be the standard for the United States across the line, and it'd be nice to have Alaska in it sooner rather than later. And I'll answer any questions that you might have.
Great. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions of Mr. Christensen? Representative Hayes?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think I have my question for Mr. Christensen, but I am curious. It sounds like this bill is going through state by state by state. Why the folks who wanted this bill introduced didn't just start it on a federal level? It just seemed it would have been a lot easier to pass it on a national level than to go state by state by state. I'm
well,
just curious.
And I guess I'll direct the question to Mr. Christensen, because it is in your letter. You state that new federal guidelines issued under HIPAA will require insurers to issue new prescription cards in the very near future.
Right.
Go ahead, if you can
sure.
just respond to that.
My understanding is that the pharmacy associations have tried to work with the insurers and the National Council on Prescription Drug Cards to make it, what we're talking about, pretty much voluntary, to try to get the insurers online. So this is a voluntary kind of a thing rather than, you know, a state or a federal mandated thing. But it just hasn't happened very fast. It's been in the works for about 4 years. And with regards to HIPAA, HIPAA really doesn't require the issuance of prescription cards, but the fact is they're out there. And one of the things that we're being told is, for example, on most of your prescription drug cards now, Social Security numbers are used quite frequently. For example, with the state's plan that Representative Roper referred to, those cards are identified by a Social Security number. We're told that in the future that will probably be not on there anymore as part of a patient privacy protection. So again, that's going to have to be on a card, and I wish it would come down federally. We wouldn't have to be here, but the fact of it is it hasn't come down. So state by state, it seems like we're working through it.
Thank you, Mayor.
Representative Roper?
Well, the answer to the question is that the states have primacy on insurance. This is a health insurance issue. This is states' rights. I mean, every insurance issue we have is the same way, right? Right? Like every other bill, the next one coming up, the next one coming up. I mean, it's because we have primacy over the health issues as well. Until the federal government asserts itself and that conflict and battle that goes on.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Okay. I don't have anybody else signed up to testify. Is there anyone? Yes.
Madam Chairman, this is Mike Wiggins in Seattle with Aetna. We would like to testify.
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Wiggins.
Actually, for those who don't know who I am, my name is Mike Wiggins. I'm a vice president of National Accounts. I'm here in Seattle with Nicole Salinas. And we make up the core account management team for the state of Alaska self-funded plan. Actually, I have some prepared comments here, but maybe it might, since there's a lot of questions that have been going out there, and some may have some for me. But just a general comment, I'm glad to hear there's no problem with the state of Alaska ID card. And it seems appears to be working. I've spent most of my day unfortunately, I'm probably working on not Bill J of 318, but the prior bill. That was what we were told was the most current. And based on our review of that, we have some questions about the bill, and we're not sure it's the current ID card as it stands today. We'll meet that because of the bill. We spent most of today also working with the health care identification card pharmacy ID put out.
I guess I'm going back to your first statement that says you don't think that, that your card complies, and I guess I'm trying to understand where it doesn't, and I you missed me.
You want to go item by item?
Sure.
Okay. The first part here that we can't tell hasn't been defined by the bill. It talks about, it's just a clarification here. It talks about the covered individual's identification number. Currently, Dave, for the state of Alaska,
okay, well, wait.
The member number of the employee.
All right, hold up 1 minute. You know, it's not going to do us any good for you to be working off a draft that we don't have before us. If you're going to...
Those provisions are in the old one. Right?
Well...
Yeah, they're in the... I apologize for... We are trying to get version J as fast as we can speak. We were unaware that there had been another version out there.
Well, the version's been out, I guess, for a couple of days, but has it been faxed to you?
It hasn't. We're trying to get it. We got what was on the legislative net today, and it was not the version we have in for us is what came off the legislative net today.
Representative Murkowski, this is Lise Burton. If Mike would give me his fax number, I'd be happy to fax him version J.
Well, we can fax it from here. That's not the issue. It isn't going to help us to have you go down a version that we don't have in front of us. So I would rather you... have version J, which is our working document for the committee.
Chairman McCaskey, would it make sense here? I don't know if it takes the committee's time for us to get version J instead of our comments in writing.
That would probably be very helpful. Can you give us the facts right now? We'll make sure that you get a copy right now.
206-701-8175.
Okay, great. Thanks.
I guess I just want to restate here, Aetna does support a standardized card. But what we found at the state level, that when the enactment of the state system source, they've all been different bills with different requirements. We think that for efficiency, for all parties here, a standardized legislation is a good idea. We just don't see that currently in practicality happen at the state level. It will require federal enactment of legislation.
Well, let me ask you this then. You know, these are pretty little cards. They're fitting in your wallet. How radically are these, the various state requirements, how radically do they differ? I just can't imagine that there are some that are just so different than what Alaska might be proposing as opposed to what Washington has.
Madam Chair, this is Jack McCray from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Maybe I could respond to that.
Sure, Jack, go ahead.
In Washington and Oregon both, as mentioned earlier, 19 states have passed this similar legislation, and we've worked with both the states on this legislation. Generally speaking, what has happened in both Oregon and Washington is the legislation has not been specific of what should be on the card as much as given the authority of the regulatory agency, which you have in your bill, the director shall regulate, to then work with the pharmacy groups and the carriers to establish what should be on the card. Again, I apologize, I'm not working off the J copy either of the House bill, and there are some concerns we have of what's listed there under the different items and the definitions of them. And again, I apologize, what you're looking at might be different. But we're not opposing the bill. I don't want to give you that impression because we support. We don't have a major problem with the legislation. We just want to make sure that what happens is as uniform as possible in Washington, Oregon, Alaska, because in Alaska we have 85,000 members up there, and if there's one change in the card, it would require us to send out 85,000 new cards just in Alaska alone. So. We would like to work with the committee on it on this issue, but we're not opposed to the bill itself. We're just concerned about some of the definitions themselves in the bill.
Okay, if you would do the same thing then that Mr. Wiggins is doing and get version J and send us your written comments, that would be appreciated. Okay. Anybody else? Is there anyone here in Juneau that wishes to testify? Okay, I'm going to hold this bill over until we get these comments. And Representative Roper?
Madam Chair, I think that there's also been some testimony here that I'd like to make sure that the perhaps covered in any other committee substitute might come forward is the issues that relate to who is to be, who's to qualify. It seems to me if we're going to have this, then even Medicaid recipients should have a card. And right now, I'm not sure a health benefit plan is defined in statute. I was going to ask Katie Campbell if it was. Do you know if health benefit plan is defined in our?
My name is Katie Campbell. I'm a life and health actuary at the Division of Insurance, and I too don't have a copy of.
Well, it says a health benefit plan. It provides.
Is
what is the who in this bill right now? So we have a definition of that in statute. We have all kinds of benefit. We have all kinds of definitions, but
right. Actually, a health benefit plan is defined in Chapter 54. I think it's 54-500. So it is defined in that chapter that applies generally, and it's one of the definitions that went in when we made all of the HIPAA changes.
Would that include any Medicaid recipients under state receipts, do you know? And that's out of your area, though. I don't know.
I
guess we'll have to look at the definition, right?
The definition is in written in terms of employee welfare benefit plans, so it's very general. It would apply, but Medicaid probably wouldn't qualify as a.
And maybe it should. That's one thing I just
mm-hmm.
wanted to bring to
mm-hmm.
attention.
Yeah.
And then another thing is that the way this is drafted, this is a health benefit plan that provides coverage, et cetera, for drugs or devices, and that issues, uses, requires, or reissues a card. Well, if they didn't use a card, then they wouldn't be subject to it. So I'm not sure you want to say that. So with that, I'll...
we'll take a look at that, too. Thank you.
And if I could ask Mr. Wiggins a question.
You bet.
Mike Norm Rokeberg, the privacy issue, your familiarity with the Alaska Patient Bill of Rights and other issues of privacy up here, is there any impacts along those lines?
Norm, I guess I have done enough to be specific to that. I've just recently been working with the state of California on this privacy conference. They're basically eliminated the social number, and that's going to make a requirement for major rewrites of eligibility systems that are coming off the payroll system. It's going to cause a big change in the software for doctors' offices who use social numbers as identifiers. Plus, we're going to have to come up with sort of encrypted software to work with that. But I'm not specifically aware or have done analysis on state. But privacy is a big issue going nationwide when they're looking at ID cards. So there's two things that are going on nationally. They're looking at ID cards for medical confidentiality. And those same cards at the same time are being used for prescription guard. Prescriptions, and so they kind of compound the issues.
Well, if you could check with our benefits people up here and on anything, because there's several bills that have been floating around about Social Security numbers up
mm-hmm.
here too that I'm concerned about, as well as the Patient's Bill of Rights and any other privacy issues here. So I'm sure you can look into them along with Jack.
Yeah, we'll do that here.
Thanks.
Great.
I guess the thing that I just want to reemphasize with Jack, and I said, we're not against standardized cards. We're just having to deal with a lot of different, you know, being enacted in 19 states, that's a statement. What it doesn't say here, and I need to find out, the only ones I read today were New Mexico, North Carolina, and Texas. But they're different. And who regulates them, who's compliant, current bill, and I didn't read Jay, and it may just be that I need some clarity of what those data elements mean here.
that at a congressional level. And we see in the future, and I don't know what time frame we're looking at, but we see going to a different identifier than Social Security numbers.
Thank you, Ken. Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my curiosity question is, why haven't any other companies looked at federal legislation and then just had the legislation do a reciprocity format like the bills that we were looking at last year? It just seems if you wanted standardization per state, then that would have been the easiest way to go about doing this.
Just a general comment here.
Who's speaking, please?
We insure 18 million people throughout the country, and we are presently using somewhat standard cards for all 18 million that are throughout the country. I'm not sure, maybe Jack can comment. There may be some ID card standards at the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association level, and so maybe it's not that different from each plan. I don't know. Jack, I that's a constant question.
That was
Jack, and yes, there are some standards at Blue Cross Blue Shield. And as mentioned earlier, our card in all the states, generally speaking, fulfill the requirements of what's in the legislation. But from a standpoint of our concern is kind of the definition of what some of these terms would be, because if it changes a little bit, we'd have to send out another 85,000 new cards. So we'd like to work through some of the definitions pertaining to legislation.
Okay, and with regards to the reissuance, I think we had this discussion very early on when this was first brought to the committee for review. And I don't think that every time there's a change in something that goes on in the program or whatever that a new card has to be reissued. It's when it's time for the card to be reissued, at that time it would be changed. But we'll make sure that it basically says everything that we think we want it to say.
Madam Chair, just for some
can
more
you,
information, we do not reissue cards
me.
On any basis.
I don't know who's speaking. You need to identify yourself, please.
This is Jack McCray again.
Thanks,
I apologize.
I don't recognize all the male voices on the other end.
This is Jack McCray with Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. And we don't reissue cards at any set time. We reissue cards when the data changes on it. Just for an information purpose.
Okay, thank you.
This is Mike Wiggins. We do the same here. To get the initial ID card, we've created an internet vehicle or from our member service where people can request cards when they lose them, and for new enrollees they get ID cards. It's just because of the cost to send them out.
Okay, are there further questions of anybody online? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate your input, your testimony. As I've indicated, we'll hold this over until we receive the comments back from both Aetna and Blue Cross and anybody else that would care to weigh in on the on version J, and we will take it up once we get that feedback. And last on the calendar today, a continuation of House Bill 290, Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. When last we met, we had several people who had indicated a desire to testify. I see that Mr. Bell has left. Was he planning on speaking to this bill, or?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure.
Okay, well, he was first on my list. I guess we've missed him. Mr. George.
Yeah.
He can come second.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is John George. I'm here today representing American Council of Life Insurance and Aflac. In your folder, there is a proposed amendment, which I'm not proposing that you consider today. In further discussions with my client and with the sponsor of the bill, Representative Roachberg has asked for some more information, and we'd rather propose an amendment that he was in agreement with, and so ask him not to take any action and even consider the amendment that I put in your folder the other day. But let me just say that we fully support the concept of Representative Roachberg's bill to broaden the base of people that pay into the subsidy of these ACHEA policies. As it is now, the small employer, the single person buying their own individual policy are paying a substantial burden, while many people escape contributing as well. So we do support the concept of broadening that base as much as possible to spread the pain out.
So we will disregard your proposed amendment until further notice.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions of Mr. George?
Yeah.
Representative Roper.
To the chair, Mr. George, in our discussions about this, one of the issues is the scope of the definition of like major medical and what's to be covered under this bill. Is that correct?
That's correct. The law as it stands now says that any insurer that sells major medical insurance policies is a member of the CHIA. And the assessment is based not on major medical premium, but all health insurance premium written by that company. In the case of Aflac, they write $14,106 worth of major medical premium, and it's Medicare supplement policies. It's not even health insurance policies as you would think of a major medical policy, but the definition includes Medicare supplements. But because they write over $5 million in premium in the state, their assessment this year will be about over $30,000. So because they write $14,000 worth of major medical, they pay $30,000 in assessment.
And if Representative Hayes wasn't down here for 4 months, it would be more, but a better premium.
Yeah.
Higher premium.
Interestingly enough, Aflac doesn't write Medicare supplement policies anymore in the state. They wrote them until 1997 or 98, but they're guaranteed renewable. So they can't cancel the policies and get off. They must renew them, and as long as they renew them, they're subject to the assessment of all their premium. So that's what we're working on, and there may be some other ways to approach it. I'm going to provide you with more information, tell you what other types of insurance they write that fall under health insurance but not major medical, and we'll get it worked out.
I appreciate that, and the testimony clarifies one point I want to work on in the bill is the scope of how we can get the premium expanded. And for Mr. George's company it could be the definition, in my opinion, should be expanded beyond that. It might make them feel better, but might not save them any money. But anyway, I appreciate that and the efforts he's brought forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hayes had a question.
On that note, Madam Chair, I probably should claim conflict at this point in time. So I'm going to claim conflict.
Right.
It's noted for the record with humor.
I'd ask. We'll get to that later. I'm going to put the Representative Hayes on the hot seat about what type of product he sells.
Next, let's go to Director Bell.
He wants to buy some insurance. I'm Guy Bell, Director of the Division of Retirement Benefits, and just have a few comments. Following along with the testimony of Bob Lohr and Mr. George, we too, Department of Administration, support expanding those who can be assessed under the CHIA program, in the view of the need for equity and an equitable approach to this issue. Just a couple of comments. First, on the legislation, the bill identifies the state of Alaska as one of the groups. Now, from our perspective, the retirement benefits, that means two groups: select benefits. State employees covered under a plan that we administer, and that's about 5,000 state employees, and state and political subdivision retirees under the public employees and teachers retirement systems, and that's something over 23,000 people. That's who we think would be affected by that reference to the state of Alaska. There are certain groups that would not include, and I think Bob Lohr made some reference to them in his testimony the other day. And we've based our fiscal note on numbers from the Division of Insurance, assuming that those two groups, select benefits and retirees, would be assessed. Because the employer contribution to insurance in select benefits is capped, either in statute for non-covered people or through collective bargaining agreements otherwise, we've indicated that this increase would be assessed against state employees based on the current law. And that's why we've shown an asterisk on fiscal impact, because really the premium increase would go to employees as opposed to the employer under the current law. And that's why we, just an explanation of the asterisk on the fiscal law.
If I could interject just right here, just to clarify that point that Mr. Bell is that that's because the $500 figure is in statute right now.
That's the amount of the employer contribution
is actually in statute.
Yes.
Okay. Just to make sure that's understood by everybody. Okay.
To retirees, we've indicated also the impact on the retirement funds, and it's a little bit confusing, but I'll just give a brief synopsis. The retirement funds are actuarially funded, which means we pre-fund obligations associated with the retirement system. So the actual cost to the retirement funds in the first or in any year will be greater than the amount of the assessment against the retiree plans, because we're collecting in advance for active employees as well as paying for the assessment for retirees. So there's effectively a double hit when it comes to the retirement funds because of our actuarial funding approach. Now, in a conversation I had today with Representative Rookberg, I must acknowledge that this is a savings the retirement funds received some years ago when we went from being fully insured to being self-insured. So at one point, of course, the retirement funds were paying their share of this cost up to the point to 1997 when both the retiree and the active plans became self-insured.
If I could make a comment.
Rucker.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Bell, referring back to our conversation, is that one could make the case that particularly the retirees had already actuarially made the payments up until that point that they ceased making payments. So they have prepaid up until that time. And then they only ceased when the state went self-insured, so there's only a small period of time. And then the figure you have here, which is like $1 million, which is pretty substantial, given that the premiums are only, the whole assessment now is what, was $3.5 million or something like that?
Yes.
Right. Would be that you're almost double paying in the future, and you can make the case that you wouldn't really need to do that if you gave credit for their prepayments previously. Help me out here.
In a theoretical sense, I think that's true. But
right.
First, we're looking at what, based on what the Division of Insurance has told us, the share, what 23 of what our premium share would be of the total, and that annual assessment would be $1 million against the retiree plans. But our fiscal note indicates that the annual cost to employers who pay rates to the retirement funds would be about $2 million, $2.2 million, and that's because we were actuarially funded. Because we're collecting, we have to collect not only for the $1 million in premium we'll pay in year one, but we also have to pre-fund future payments for currently active employees. And that's because when I retire, theoretically, the retirement fund is collected from employers, from my employer and me, 100% of my expected retirement benefit. And this is effectively a piece of the retirement benefit, although it doesn't, it's just part of the cost of retirement benefit.
Follow-up
question, Mr.
Rucker?
Yes. Going back to this actuarial compensation with in the previous deposits, do you think that by statutory definition we could require that the previous deposits be given for those previous deposits when you make the computation, or how do we get credit for those deposits?
Representative Rookberg, from the retirement system's perspective, and I'll just talk about public employees' retirement system. Every employer is like a separate bucket, and we take all of the employer contributions to the retirement system for, let's say, the state of Alaska, and put that in a bucket. And that bucket is to be used to fund all future obligations. Now, we don't segregate the pension obligation, from the medical obligation, from the other obligations. There's just a bucket, and we take that bucket and we measure, that's our asset, and we measure that against our expected liability. And if there's a difference, we charge a higher rate to that employer to cover the difference. And effectively, I think what happened is that our medical costs modestly dropped when we went to self-insurance, and so the liability associated with medical dropped. But at the same time, employer rates came down, maybe partly because of this, but also because of other issues, investment returns and so on. There's just a lot of things that go into determining assets and liabilities.
So it all got commingled in the pot, and it's really hard to say.
You can't really segregate it.
But on the other hand, in terms of the fairness in trying to implement or re-implement this system and spread not the wealth, but the pain around, it just seems to me that there's an equity issue in terms of not getting credit for those payments that are already made actuarially. And so, I mean, and therefore, because I don't want to create too big a burden or too big a fiscal note, no matter where the costs fall down, is there a way we can finesse that to make it work, is what I'm getting at.
Why not?
We're talking actuaries here. This stuff
is
I'm sorry.
Is there a way we can bring equity to this equation and get some credit for those costs?
Madam Chair, this is Bob Lohr. Could I possibly attempt a partial answer to that?
Well, let Mr. Bell first.
I think that the short answer to the question is that by adding an obligation to the retiree medical plan, there is an increased cost. And there's no place else that it can come from, because the retirement, for 99% of retirees, the retirement funds pay 100% of the premium. But this, I must say, though, that although this looks like a large number in terms of the total asset size of the retirement funds, we're not talking a substantial amount. We have approximately, at least as of last June, $12 to $13 billion in the retirement funds, and we're talking about a relatively modest obligation to the total. And there are other factors that would have a much larger impact on employer rates than a relatively modest change in relating to CHIA, let's say CHIA assessments. Now, I'd add that if the pool is expanded to a larger size, that that this legislation does not just add on select benefits and retirees, that that amount will drop. So as the number of people, individuals affected by this expanded, the cost, let's say, to the retirement system will go down commensurately.
Right, so if we are able to expand the amount of coverage here and toss the net wider, those costs would go down.
Mm-hmm.
I guess my point is that looks like a very high cost in the scope of what the bill is trying to attain, some $2 million, when that's basically all the premiums are now.
It's basically
makes the bill look bad. The total guaranteed premiums right now aren't much over that. But they have to actuarially put this money aside now for the down the road. But they did it in the past, so where is that money? So that's kind of what I'm getting at here. I'm trying to bring the issue up to the committee so we can deal with that. They already paid the money, but now they didn't get credit for it. That's the point. So is it fair to double up on them now? I mean, I don't think it is, really. But I understand that they do have to, of course, charge now for it.
I understand in a note from my staff that I need to research whether or not the retirement funds did, in fact, pay a premium in the past toward CHIA.
Well, that would be a good idea. That was our understanding between you and I earlier.
And I may stand corrected, so I need to get back on that.
Okay. Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just for my edification here and clarification, I was under the impression what Commissioner Lohr said the other day that this would expand the CHIA premiums to the ERISA plans that had stop loss insurance, that it would really cast a broad net and would be very cheap for each individual. Am I wrong in that assumption?
No, I don't think so. I think that's right, and I want to verify that with them on the stop loss. So the greater number, the bigger the net, all of it can go down. What this first note was done, as Mr. Bell mentioned, was based on just these particular, the smaller cohort or smaller group of people. Hopefully we'll be able to expand that, so it will go down. I've just got my nose out of joint about this high fiscal note, when if there is in fact money's paid in previously, it's because it's all done on an actuarial basis, not a current cost basis. So when you have $2.2 million and $2.5 million for the whole program right now, that seems a little bit, and we have the private sector paying all of it now, so it doesn't quite add up. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like we'll get some additional research done on that and get it back to the committee. Or
yes, and yes, Senator, I know it's kind of late in the day to try to explain how actuarial funding methods work, but this was never really looked at as when Mercer, our actuary, does valuations, they don't look at the obligations item by item. They look at the total. They look at the aggregate. And so they won't look at, the cost of...
Well, then they shouldn't look at it again. If they didn't take it into account before.
Well, but we're adding something.
Well, son of a gun. Excuse me, man, Chair.
Are there any further questions of Mr. Bell before we go to Director Lohr? I know he had a comment that he wanted to provide. Seeing none. Mr. Lohr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bob Lohr, Director of the Division of Insurance. It was really just a non-substantive procedural comment that if it turns out that they have been actuarially pre-funded, possibly transitional language in the temporary and special acts would be one way to handle that. But I'm sure Representative Roker is aware of that. And concerning Representative Crawford's comment, I do agree with Representative Roker that the intent, as I understand it, of the bill and the certainly our conceptual support for it is based on the notion that by broadening the applicability of the assessment, you would in fact bring the rates down for all payers into the CHIA fund. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have
go ahead, Representative Roper.
Mr. Lohr, let me just verify that again in terms of the stop loss. It's your belief that we can define this to include stop loss people, but do we have to go, and I don't want to get into the covered lives versus premium issue right now. We need to get that worked out, and I wasn't able to get back to Katie on that yet. But... is it your belief that we can go to those organizations that have stop loss now?
Madam Chair, Representative Roper, that is correct. We do believe you can go there. I hope that you've seen this afternoon a letter from Signe Anderson, the Assistant Attorney General, who did respond to the question about the applicability of ERISA and possible preemption there. Despite her opinion, we do believe that stop loss policies are reachable, and in fact other states have successfully included them in the assessment base for comparable programs in those states. And to my knowledge, there has not been a legal challenge, let alone a successful legal challenge against that as somehow violative of ERISA or preempted by ERISA. So I believe you can do that. In fact, I think it's important in the rate design of this assessment to ensure that you don't make stop loss coverage unaffordable or do anything to drive it out of the state. It is an important insurance feature, and you certainly would not want to assess it unduly in some fashion that might jeopardize the availability of the coverage. And I think all of that can be handled rather carefully in the design of the actual assessment figures themselves.
Right. Could you request your counsel to look into that or provide a letter to that effect?
We can certainly ask her. Sorry, Madam Chair. We can, Representative Roper, we can certainly ask her to supplement the opinion. All of the available literature that we've reviewed, both legal and programmatic, suggests that this is a viable method of assessing premium for the comprehensive health insurance programs, and that it is in active and growing use by states as a base for assessment.
In Madam Chair, one of my other, Mr. Lloyd, there's the right now the bill calls for those that are offer major medical coverage. I have a concern about that, and I think I'm leaning towards trying to expand that definition. Mr. George brought up the situation with Aflac, and brings to mind that there's other types of coverage being written, perhaps. And I think that's one thing I want to work with your division on in that area.
Madam Chair, Representative Roper would be happy to work with you on that, and I do believe that, in general, the broader the base, the better from the point of view of managing the impact on private insurance market generally and on all payers into the assessment.
And also expanding the scope of it, particularly to, right now, in my discussions with Mr. Bell, we talked about the bringing University of Alaska in and the other union trusts that weren't already covered. Several of them already are because they are underwritten or they would have stop loss. At least two of the union trusts I'm aware of, the state employees, are underwritten, so they would be already premium payers, like the public employees, public safety people already are. And I think either, and then Local 71 has a policy too, I think. So they would be already paying into the CHIA. So we would have to look at that. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Any other questions of Director Lohr? Thank you. Next, let's go to Craig Person. Is Mr. Person online? Oh, okay. How about, I have Jack and Jeff. Is there a Jack or a Jeff that wants to speak to this?
This is Jack McRae with Cross Blue Shield of Alaska again.
Okay, Jack, who's the Jeff?
Jeff was here. Jeff Davis out of our Anchorage office, and he was there yesterday but wasn't able to come back today.
Okay.
I just wanted to say we're very supportive of the legislation that will broaden this pool. Our costs in Alaska have run approximately $1 million a year into the pool. For 2002, it looks like our payment in the pool will just about double to a $2 million figure. And with other entities going self-insured, there seems to be an inequity of that burden being put on just the members of our commercial marketplace up there. So we're very supportive. We'd like to work with the committee in any way possible to work through some legislation in this area. One other issue I'll address on the issue of stop loss. In Washington State, they did tax stop loss last session, I believe, or it could be the session before, at a different formula than the commercial carriers. But there hasn't been any problem down here, to the best of my knowledge, with the stop loss carriers being part of the pool.
Thank you. Representative Roper.
Yeah, Jack, was that, were they taxed as part of their guarantee program or for other purposes too?
I will have to go out and pull the legislation, Representative Roper, but I believe that the rate that they're taxed was 1/10 of what the commercial carriers were taxed at, but I can't give you that exact verbiage right now. I can find that for you and get it to you tomorrow.
That'd be great. You said they may have had even a different rate?
They're paying at a different rate than what the commercial carriers are paying into the pool at a lower rate. Logic there was, as Director Lohr mentioned a minute ago, that you want to make sure that the burden is such that you don't chase the stop-loss carriers out of the state because it is a fragile marketplace.
Right, right.
Yeah. Further questions of Mr. McRae?
Oh.
Representative Roper?
Also, the if you could look, Jack, and if Mike's online too, look at the the issue of assessment by premium versus covered lives. We'll be looking at that issue also.
Chair, I'll get back to you tomorrow on that. Yes. Okay.
Jack, this is Mike. I hope you don't get back to me tomorrow on it. I should work on Saturday.
Oh, also, if I could.
Go ahead.
Jack, what, as long as you got you online now, what percentage of the market does Blue Cross have? You said you're going to go up to about $2 million of the premium. Are you, where are you in the percentages? You're way over 50% now, aren't you?
Madam Chair, Mr. Roberg, I get the feeling we've had this discussion up and on almost every session. Now we're in the commercial marketplace. We're at 85,000 lives covered up there. That doesn't include our federal program. And so we're just about 50% of the marketplace. That number, I think it's a little bit over 50%, but it's it goes back and forth between 50 and 51.
And I could ask Mike, where are you? And I think you're only about 3.6%, but that doesn't include your third-party administration, is that right?
The majority of Aetna's business here is self-funded groups, not just the state here. And I would say Jack and I are wrestling back and forth, but with the loss of GGU last year, we're probably about 20,000 less than he is. But definitely we are a significant player in the marketplace, but we kind of define defines as the commercial marketplace, and we're, most of our business is self-funded. We cover a lot of the significant employers that have home offices lower 48 that are up there. A lot of the oil companies, a lot of the others up there. So it's just in the definition.
How about the non-ERISA? How many do you have there?
Well, I think the state's non-ERISA. So that's the only one I know. Most all of our other funded groups, as far as I know, are all ERISA exempt.
Well, the state is a risk exam.
That's always a question. I don't have an opinion on that.
That's good. I like that. Okay.
I might say something, just to comment on what Jack talked about, running a fragile stop loss market. I agree with that. It's a fragile market up in Alaska, and maybe it's just an education on the type of coverage we're talking about. But a stop-loss carrier doesn't get a large premium. He may be carrying a specific stop-loss at a level, let's say, $250,000, and his premium may be $10. And so if you do an assessment on a per-covered life here, his premium is $10 here, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense if that's the way you're going to do the apportionment.
Well, it'd be better as a premium tax then, rather than a covered life.
Yes, I totally agree it would be better as a premium tax. But right now it's written on a per head, and that is written here, has some difficulties and definitely could hurt the marketplace for stop loss carriers.
Yeah.
Representative Redford?
Where are we now? We're on the premium, I thought, right? Yeah. Current basis on premium. Yeah. Okay.
Any further questions of either Mr. McRae or Mr. Wiggins? We kind of got both of them at once here. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Bykirk, you had commented on Wednesday. Is there anything additional you would like to add for the benefit of the committee? Mr. Bykirk there? Yes, he doesn't have to add anything. How about Nicole Salinas?
No, Nicole's with myself here, and we were on the agenda for last time. I think we've had our comments.
Okay.
There's more questions from us.
It's yesterday, isn't it?
No, it's today. We've got a new form. I don't like it. Okay, I don't have anybody else either online or here in Juneau that has signed up to testify. Am I missing anybody here in Juneau? All right, the sponsor has asked that we hold this over as he continues to work through the process on it, but it's been some good information. I think the committee has benefited from it, and I certainly appreciate you bringing it forward.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to make sure everybody's kind of tuned into it because there are a few complex issues here, and there could be some some political type ramifications, which there really shouldn't be. That's not my intention, and I really am very pleased that the administration has indicated their general support conceptually for this bill. Well, that's a major thing, and I'm really happy about that. So. that shows that we can have a make this a bipartisan thing, and not, and this is not intended to hurt like the union trust and the one out and so forth. There, we got another bill on that one, but this one is to make sure that everybody equitably is paying into this very important program that we need to continue, and which is growing, and we need to have that insurance available for everybody in the state. And unless we reform how we pay for it, and we have testimony that Blue Cross is paying half the premium at $2 million a year, we're in real trouble, I think. So we need to expand that base of contribution into the program and make sure it's a viable program for the future.
It's good. I really do appreciate you bringing it forward. Okay, next week we've got a bunch of exciting things. It's I don't know whether it's slow time in the building, but we seem to be getting all the airtime, so I'm here to tell the viewers that tune in next week for Minimum Wage and Euthanasia.
Oh, oh my.
With that, we're adjourned at